Longer ladders don't get you to the moon by Michael Gordon. Sundials came into being over 3,000 years ago, telling time based on shadows cast by the sun. But they were thrown off by variations in the length of days and by differences in latitude. Geometry was used only partially successfully to fix these problems. And of course, sundials were useless at night. Clocks based on gravity instead of shadows attempted to fix these problems. Water clocks, water dripping through a narrow opening, could be used whatever the season or latitude. But they were fragile, not easily transportable, necessary for navigation, and difficult to use. And to produce precisely enough to tell good time. Hourglasses, still based on gravity, but now using sand instead of water, solved some of these problems, but still weren't particularly accurate or easy to standardize. At least, not compared to the next generation of clocks, which relied on springs and gears. Fast forward to today, and there are atomic clocks that are incredibly accurate and reliable, which work by counting electrons moving back and forth nearly 10 billion times per second. Notice that each advance is not only more accurate and useful, it's also based on an entirely different principle than its successors, excuse me, the rotation of the Earth, gravity, mechanics, physics, and the oscillation of atoms. And this is how non-incremental changes in technology occur, applying new principles. You can't keep tweaking a technology and get better and better results. Eventually, a principle must change. Longer and longer ladders don't get you to the moon. The economy, though it's gigantic, is itself a technology. And maybe it needs new principles, different principles by which the economy might operate. So that it benefits more people and respects that we are a part of, not apart from, nature. What might those look like? What's in it for me underlies most economic thinking. Economists dating back to Adam Smith have argued that acting from self-interest will produce a vibrant economy for all. Perhaps we should be asking, what's in it for us to bring things into balance? It's not personal, it's strictly business. As uttered by Michael Corleone in The Godfather, this principle explains how to keep score by results and outcomes. Perhaps better guidance is to focus on relationships and what is personal. In how we operate, and let results flow from there. Survival of the fittest. This one's about power, and it's both advice, get strong yourself, and a threat, so as not to be overrun by those stronger than you. Likely, this principle is the one that most ensnares us. Because there is always someone or something with more might, more money, more influence, or behaving more aggressively than we are, which can convince us that we and the systems we create need to become more powerful too. Our continual striving, one-upping, our need to perform and be rewarded, to outshine, to reap the rewards, These patterns seep into our lives and undergird the systems we build and live by. Yet, no matter how high up the ladder of power we climb, we never reach a safe spot at the top. Until finally, we recognize the ladder is leaning against a wall there's no getting past. Unless we change a fundamental principle. Unless we move away from our belief that with enough power, things will get better. And toward what spiritual leaders might call love or compassion. Does this seem crazy? It would have to me a few years back. If so, here's food for thought, attributed to the 10th century German philosopher Nietzsche. And those who were seen dancing were thought to be insane by those who could not hear the music. Let's listen.
Thank you, Brenda. That's a beautiful reading. And we'll hand the mic over to Michael to share some initial reflections on the beautiful passage that he wrote. Michael, over to you.
Thank you for the reading, and thank you for the invitation to join this wonderful circle. Some of you know me, some of you don't. I was once upon a time a PhD student in computer science. I mean, I got a PhD in computer science, and particularly in complex systems. So that's sort of my old history, but it finds its way to this article. And then through some set of causes and conditions that I still don't completely understand, I ended up in a business school. I've never taken a business school course in my entire life. And I taught there for 37 years. So I guess I did okay. And you know, I want to honor two people whose work finds its way into this article you just read. And by the way, this is a slightly edited version of something that I wrote in notes to self. I'm not sure if I even had the, I don't think I shared this title with Nipun, who shared this with these awakened circles, but my original title for this talk is called Clocks and Love. And you'll see why, and I think it's hinted at in the article. But again, one of the original influences for me of this article is this guy who taught at Berkeley a long time ago, Hubert Dreyfus, who wrote a book called What Computers Can't Do, and it was a critique, an early critique of artificial intelligence. And I looked it up, it was written in 1978. And I barely remember the book too much. I remember liking it a lot, but he used the metaphor of trying to climb a ladder and get to the moon and realizing this is just futile. And then another influence is this guy, Brian Arthur, who worked at the Santa Fe Institute, the Center for Complex Studies. And he is an economist and a complex systems guy and just a polymath. And he talked about technology and how technology is something that solves problems. And we could look at computer program as a technology, a car as technology. And I'm suggesting that business itself could be a technology. And I chose business, you know, as the subject of this article because number one, I think it's something, first of all, I taught in the business school for many, many years. But I think about that stuff. Number two, you know, it's kind of a powerful organizing force in society. And on top of that, it sort of has seeped in metaphorically, I think, into our understanding of how the world works. You know, we talk about investing in, you know, ourselves or investing in a home or doing something profitably, or there's a lot of ways that are competition. That's all part of the business vernacular. And I think it sort of has tilted us too strongly toward this, what's in it for me? So why this paper? Actually, Nipun asked me if I would just explain why I wrote this paper. And I figured, well, that's pretty easy. And then I realized I had no idea why I wrote this paper. So I thought about it. And one of the ideas, honestly, was just in response to all the symptoms out there. It's not too hard to see wealth inequality, environment that's, crying out for our support, our repair, democracy that seems ever more fragile. And maybe not hard to see, but maybe something happens at a different level. The fact that we can't get along, unless you believe exactly the same things I do, it's really hard for me to talk to you. And that seems to be taking place around the world. So I wrote this book with that in mind. I also wrote this book because I had actually written the book. Since I wrote this paper because I'd written a book, trying to help business students think about how they might reconsider business. I have a little newsletter that goes out to, a number of people. And I wanted to share this article to give them a little teaser for what this book was about. The book's called How to Do Good with Money or Doing Good with Money. And the book itself was gifted. And I was hoping people might, see this as an invitation to pick up the book. And then thirdly, Service Space and the Law of Love by Gandhi entered my life. So all this stuff is sort of context for this article. And the essence of the article simply is that when a technology, gets broken, when it can't do what it needs to do, something fundamental has to change. So propeller planes, for example, used to grab the air and pull a plane forward. And they did so really, really well until they needed to go faster and fly higher. And the air got too thin and all the plane parts started shuddering. And a new principle had to come into being. And that's true with clocks, like I was trying to refer to this article, as well as everything else. And so looking at the world today and all these symptoms I was alluding to, we need a new principle. We need a new principle. And so I'm suggesting to me that principle has something to do with the law of love. And the law of love, Gandhi's, the law of love is a little mini book, by the way, that collects many of Gandhi's sayings about ahimsa and love together. And I've actually been going through this book with a friend of mine, paragraph by paragraph. And we write each other commentary back and forth with like old rabbinical scholars or something. And the law of love is trying to say that doing no harm, aggressively doing no harm, or assertively doing no harm is our task. And it binds us and it's enduring. Otherwise, we would have fallen apart as a society eons ago. And it's more powerful than anything else. And so that was the law of love piece of this, that again, this article is supposed to be called Clocks and Love. And then finally, you might change an airplane. You might change an airplane and say, we need a new principle. We need a new principle that takes us from a propeller plane that grabs the air to a jet propulsion plane, which pushes air out the back and uses chemical reactions, et cetera, burning fuel. But there's a more profound kind of change, which is the change of an entire domain. So not only did airplanes start changing and clocks start changing, industries change. The ways people talk about things change, the customs change, the vocabulary changes. And so that really is how big system change happens, emergent change happens. That's one way of looking at it. And it happens particularly when there's an encounter between two things that seemed like they had nothing to do with each other. So once upon a time, banking, as an example, had absolutely nothing to do with digital technology. And they bumped into each other and sort of glommed onto each other. And now the idea of non-digital banking seems crazy. In fact, we have a whole series of, things that we're all familiar with, Venmo just being one of many, 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 many that were inconceivable even to think about years ago. And so to me, we now have AI doing the same kind of thing. AI is bumping into everything, including business. It's bumping into much more than business, of course, but it is also bumping into wiz business. And as the original article said, what AI can't do by Hubert Dreyfus, what computers can't do, and it was a warning about AI, we're in jeopardy of having runaway AI exacerbate all the problems we have. Unless, and here's the question I want to leave us with, unless we can figure out how to get off this ladder we're all climbing, a ladder of self-interest, a ladder of what's in it for me. And perhaps as we climb off this ladder, induce others to get off the ladder with us. So that's my question.
Oh, thank you, Michael. That's wonderful. We have a question for you, Michael. Should we go alphabetically or reverse alphabetically from M? You get to choose.
That's a question to me
Yeah.
alphabetically.
Okay. If we're going alphabetically, that means Nipun is next, and then Peter, and then Randiv. And I think we collectively have maybe 48.75268 seconds per person to share.
Okay. All right. Okay. And Michael, thank you, Michael. As it's such an honor to have you in our circle. Thank you, Brenda, for the reading. My name is Nipun. Yeah, so many things that come up, but I think the one thing that I think the crux of it that Michael was talking about. It's funny, we usually talk about, we say the author is speaking like this, but in this case, Michael is here. So, but I think the point about changing the whole operating system, it made me think of not just linear change, which is like trying to build a bigger ladder or trying to climb up, but exponential change that just changes the game. And so if I think about exponential, I was thinking of something, a very simple example, like movement. Like most of our movements are so conditioned. So there's this guy is like considered an expert. I forget his last name. His first name is Ilya. And he talks about practicing unconditioned movement every day. She's like, oh, I just did a movement that I've never done before. Right. And what that does is it like keeps your brain fresh in some sense. And so I think there's something about like, doing unconditioned things, at least at the baseline of our awareness, in some way, so that we can think in a non-linear way, so that we can act in a non-linear way individually, but then also in smaller groups and in bigger and bigger sort of collective circles. So I think for me, Michael's reading was really an invitation to think about places in our lives where we can really change the fundamental operating system. And what will be those small practices? What will be the personal practices? But also then small group practices and then large cultural practices. And how do we step into that? And how do each of those things like reinforce each other? So, with that note, here's an unconditioned movement. Never done before by this body named Nipun. Yeah. I see Bonnie's joining in. Oh, R-yay,
I
boom.
feel like you've done that before.
Audrey's it's an AI thing. I've got it captured. Yeah. Here. Oh, Shayla. Oh, I have not done the Shayla move. All right. Thank you so much.
That's great. Thank you. Who will go to Peter next and then to Randy?
Hello, everybody. Good to see you all. The first thing that hit me with this is that I have a brother a couple years older who wants to build a family legacy. So he's building that ladder. He's climbing that ladder. He wants to do all of that. And I was obviously kind of feeling the opposite of what the way that he feels. And then I had to stop a moment. I had to realize, wow, that's a lot of energy. That's a lot of effort. That's a lot of work that he's putting into holding that up. And in that, I had to find some compassion for him. Rather than criticism of what he was doing, I had to go to a place of compassion for what he was trying to do and where he's at in his life. And then I'm taking this class, and I just happened to open this book that we're reading, and it's from Anthony DeMello. And it just hit me real strongly. And and the title of it was Don't Change. And I'm gonna read it real quick. It's a short one. I was a neurotic for years. I was anxious and depressed and selfish. Everyone kept telling me to change. I resented them and I agreed with them and I wanted to change, but simply couldn't, no matter how hard I tried. What hurt the most was that, like the others, my best friend kept insisting that I change, so I felt powerless and trapped. Then one day he said to me, "Don't change. I love you just as you are." Those words were music to my ears. Don't change, don't change, don't change. I love you as you are. I relaxed. I came alive, and suddenly I changed. Now I know that I couldn't really change until I found someone who loved me, whether I changed or not. And he finishes, "Is that how you love me, God?" And, I just really realized that it's my own angst within my own self. It's not about my brother or what he's trying to do. It's where am I at? Where can I find peace within this? Where can I find love within this? And then have the change happen. So I am complete.
That's great. Thank you, Peter. We will go to Randeep and then Saroj.
Thank you, Michael. Well, Nipun, you're attracting great people to this circle. I'm just a small fry living my little, tiny little life here. This passage speaks of great things, of systems change or world change. I find that hard to understand. I find it easier for me to understand my little world here that I live in, with my family and so on, and the people that are around me. And I liken this focus on the very small and the very local as the atoms making up that ladder. That ladder is really going to be in place as long as the atoms don't change. And, I kind of realized, thinking back, living almost 50 years on the planet, taking me a long time to realize things, that maybe I'm 60, 70% selfish in my day-to-day with the people immediately in my life, right around me. And I feel like it's, for me at least, I feel like I want to change those atoms first before, I can actually grapple with the larger parts of the ladder around it. So I feel like the family unit is super important. And I think Peter mentioned that to some extent, speaking of brothers as well, those relationships we have with our closest friends and our families, they are the strongest relationships, and they are relationships that never leave. No matter what we do, a brother is still a brother, a sister is still a sister, an uncle, a mother, and so on. That I think if we can figure out how to be less self-centered and more system thinking within those families, that's how that ladder is going to transform into something else. And that's my worldview. Thank you.
Thanks, Randeep. We'll go to Saroj and then Shiloh.
I think I'm just going to pass and listen to all this wisdom that's going on. Thank you.
Namaste, and most beautiful, grateful to be over here. My name is Shaila. Lovely reading, Brenda, and what a joy, Michael, to hear your reflections. And my question would be, yes, Peter, thank you for sharing that as well about don't change. What are the practices, daily practices one could use to get off the ladder of what's in it for me? So I'll pass with that. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Shaila. We'll go to Swaraj and then Swaroop and then Wendy.
Hello, everyone. I'm glad I got here just in time to read Brinda's passage opening. So I was glad I was able to make it because it's been almost what, 5 months since I heard it, and it was great. And Michael, it's lovely to see you again. I think I've crossed paths with you in the past. So I'm happy you made it. It was a lovely passage. The initial part reminded me of my favorite movie, Interstellar, and it's getting re-released in theaters sometime this year, so I definitely recommend going to watch that when it comes out. And then just thinking of like the rest of the passage, it kind of reminded me of like certain times when I'm back home and I'm talking to some elders about a lot of like religious slash like year-long practices that have carried on. And like the certain ways you're supposed to sit, the certain ways your house is supposed to be built. And in all of those, they're like when it's fully connected, like, hey, the God is supposed to sit in this direction, or the door is supposed to be here because of XYZ spiritual reasons or things like that. Sometimes I do question it, but then oftentimes what happens is I also get like that separate view of like, hey, it's not just because of the spiritual, just because it's cultural, but more so because scientifically also this is where the sunlight is for majority of the day. So your window should be in this direction, and this is how the wind flows through the house. So that's why it's supposed to be in this angle. And so it's just kind of, to me, I always feel like, hey, why do we follow these writings or these just blindly often these things that have been just passed on, and we kind of just keep climbing that ladder or continuing to stay on it. But then at the same time, I sometimes realize that, hey, half of those things are not just because they've been said that you have to do it, but because there's reasons for it. And I think the other half is what I would like to continue to work on exploring and learning if there needs to be change or if I need to look at it from a different lens.
Good evening, everyone. As always, grateful to be here. And Michael, it was great to hear directly from you your reflections on the passage. And I thought it was pretty thought-provoking, especially as we venture into this new world of AI. The more content that feeds into these AI models that is around love, more love there is probably going to be in the future. And so I think the work that Awaken Circles and Service Space is doing is, I'm sure, part of somewhere in those AI models. And it's an interesting, thought-provoking thing to kind of like think about where, what kind of impact, a long-lasting impact is that having as we venture into this new world. So with that, I'll continue to listen.
Thanks, Arup. We'll go to Wendy next and then REA.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's good to be back. And I love, as always, hearing you read, Brenda. And thank you also, Michael, for I think we may have crossed paths also. And thank you for your discussion about your passage. It was very interesting to me. I have no head for the business world, so I'm going to veer off. What really jumped out at me was the idea of incremental change. And I'm holding, I tend to be a both and person. And so I'm holding, you know, being able to do on one hand incremental change, while on the other hand, holding paradigm shift. And I really feel you can do both. I think about, you know, in ancient times, the Homo sapiens living at the same time as Neanderthals, yeah, until the Neanderthals died out. And in my own life, you know, I was one of the early nurse practitioners, and you know, I was trained in a very medical model, but as a nurse practitioner, I was it was a new model for nursing and a new healthcare model, and we would hold skills that we learned in nursing along with skills we learned in medicine. And then when I came out here to go to graduate school, it was like, you know, I felt like I was in Oz, you know, because here I was exposed to all kinds of complementary medicine and also the human potential movement. And I still was working in a rather traditional setting. And so while I was learning about and fascinated by things like, you know, therapeutic touch and acupressure and meditation, I wasn't able to actually do that in my facility, but I was able to talk to my patients about it. And hopefully by doing that, it would help guide them to what they felt would be the most helpful to them. So I guess I'm still, as I mentioned, I'm a both and person, and I think you can be incremental while you're also trying to get that that paradigm shift. I think you can live in both worlds. So I'm going to pass this to Aryeh, who does live in both worlds and many worlds.
At least two. thank you, Brenda. Really good reading. And thank you, Michael. It's really great to have you here with us. I've never set foot in a business school in my life, so I don't know what I'm talking about, except that I come from a family where every generation was a business person. We were Jewish immigrants. My dad grew up in the east side of New York. And whether it's my grandparents, my father, my uncles, myself, my brother, we could proudly say that none of us ever held a job. We all had our own business. And in the 1970s in San Francisco, there was a network of small businesses called the Briar Patch Network. You may be familiar with it. It was started by a guy named Michael Phillips, who quit his job as a vice president of Bank of America and decided to facilitate small businesses based on the value, the Buddhist value of right livelihood. And for our purposes, we defined right livelihood as you're doing what you really love, what you're really here to do. You're doing it to be of service, and you're doing it to support yourself. And, you know, when you say business is a technology, my experience was it's an ecosystem of technologies. And the Briar Patch Network, all of us who had this goal and value of right livelihood, they were very different. One of them was a guy who had a business supplying drug paraphernalia for people who were smoking marijuana and taking various drugs. That was his business. Another business was the People's Food System, the Noe Valley Community Store. This was a Marxist, actually a Maoist organization where we would all sit around and do criticism, self-criticism, and everything was shared, and there was no such thing as profit. And each one of these, it seemed to me, had its own technology. But what the Briar Patch Network had was an ecosystem of technologies which somehow learned to coexist. And I kept doing my own small business until I stopped doing it at age 70, 10 years ago. And maybe there's a technology where there's sort of an Uber technology, and maybe there is a technology where it's an interacting system of technologies. So those are my reflections on your passage.
It's great, URA and Wendy. I think I'm next, and then Bonnie, and then Brian. And I don't know if I have more thoughts to share around this. I think a question I'm holding these days is like to what extent, like if you're flowing in a stream and you're like, I don't know, a twig or a leaf flowing in a stream, to what extent do you have the ability to like follow that flow, like that natural flow? And to what extent, like, do you kind of like
create your own little like gravitational field in that flow. I don't know. That doesn't really make sense, but I guess I've been wondering like how, like in the systems that we're entrenched in today, where there's like, I feel like I see heartbreak so much on a daily basis, like even just, you know, on a daily commute, I see like 10 people asking for change. And like when you're surrounded by all this heartbreak and brokenness, to what extent do you have, like, who do you have to be to actually like, you know, like foster love around you? And to what extent are you like, are you helpless in that, in because you're just in that, you know, in that warm water? So I don't know, I've just kind of been holding these questions of like, there's the macro and the micro, and then like, how do you keep fostering that love? That's like, that's definitely there, but yeah. Yeah, those are my thoughts for now. Over to you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Audrey, and thank you, Michael and Brenda. And it's wonderful to see all these familiar faces. Thanks so much. So I think what this reading brought up in me is something that I've been looking at for a while. So I think it's probably just the way I'm hearing it. But I just, you know, when you're changing principles, when you're shifting gears, when you're doing something that is different than what you've always done, even if you're, you know, doing a Nippon here, whatever that thing was, you know, I keep thinking of this phrase that I heard in a book about Gandhi, the Eknath Eswaran one. And there's a story where a reporter asked Gandhi what his favorite words were. And he said, renounce and enjoy. And I think about renouncing the fruits of your labors. And I think that feels like such an important part of my life right now, of just doing what I think is right and then and renouncing it. And that always used to feel sort of treacherous and scary to me. But it's starting to feel more like, oh, wow, I'm renouncing. This means it's going to be even better than I thought. You know, and I see that with this thing that you know, that Michael was saying about we're switching principles or we're doing things in a whole new way. And I can imagine, well, I don't have to imagine because I've done it, but there's a lot of clinging, you know, there's a lot of clinging to the old way. And what if we were able to be in a state of renunciation that's joyful, you know, renounce and enjoy. So that's what I'm sitting with right now. And I just really appreciate all of you and this opportunity to be with you. Thank you. And I'll pass the light to Brian.
Thanks. Thanks, Bonnie, very much. Brenda, thanks very much for that accurate and eloquent reading. And thanks, Michael, for all your reflections and for writing the article. It's a treat to have you here. You know, I don't have a whole lot to say on this because, you know, I'm really not part of the business world or the technology world. I don't understand either of them very well. But, you know, being in teaching, there's a part of me that feels that the society we live in, you know, science, technology, engineering, finance, you know, all of that is sort of valued much more than these sort of, you know, these healing or wisdom arts, you know, teaching and holistic or alternative medicine, you know, hospice care, and just all of those of us that are in, you know, what Nipun, I think, would call the gift economy. How can we have a greater impact? Something that Swaroop said kind of really caught my attention about, you know, sort of affecting AI, you know, getting more love programmed into AI. I mean, so I guess what I have more is just a question. How can those of us that are in these professions that maybe aren't valued as much within the society because, you know, they don't earn a lot of money or, you know, the great CEOs don't come from teaching or from the medical industry. You know, how can we do work? I know that individually we feel like we make an impact and we have, you know, REA talked about right livelihood. I know all of us probably feel that we're involved in right livelihood and in all the various things we do. But, you know, how could we have a greater impact, or do we have a greater impact on some of these things, such as the business world or the technological world? Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Brian. We'll go to Brenda next, and then David.
Hey, everyone. I'm so grateful to be here and hear all of your wisdom. And I'm so thankful to have Michael here to explain his beautiful passage. And I just wanted to say that Randeep's share really resonated with me, because I do agree. I think that that the change or shifts happen at the individual level first. And it reminded me of a quote. I'm probably gonna butcher it a little bit, but it's actually written, hand painted on the side of Pete Seeger's house. And he said, "I'm done with big things. I'm done with great things. I believe in the invisible molecular forces that course from individual to individual, like I can't remember the rest, but anyway, like capillaries or something to do with capillary action." But anyway, it just he called it the invisible, here it is. He called it the invisible moral molecular forces. Again, I might be getting the wording a little mixed up, but I really like those words really resonate in my heart, that on the individual level, whether Wendy's talking to a patient or whether Audrey or Brian or me were talking to a student, I feel like those interactions do make a difference in changing something. Whether it's paradigm shifting or not, I don't know. But I believe that that's all we can, or that's something that we can do. I guess that's how I look at it. And when I heard Audrey's question about the, like, with all the brokenness and everything else, you know, it's like this story about the guy who goes and rescues the fish, right? Like all the fish, a starfish, right? That are all dying. And he goes and he pulls one out and puts it back in the water. And somebody's like, "Well, why are you doing that? Doesn't make a difference." He's like, "Well, it made a difference to that one." So Audrey, you are making a difference to a lot of starfish, whether you are thinking about it or not. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. Beautiful reflections. And hey, Michael, good to see you here from Pod Feed to Awakening Circle. The sentence of economy being a technology and, you know, which needs a new set of principles struck a chord. And a few weeks ago, we had this person named Dheerath. He came to Oroville for a few weeks, and he was part of the G20 committee last year, which was hosted in India, where the theme was Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, like all world is one family. And he was part of the core group which proposed a new form of looking at economy, like completely new principles. They're calling it as life economy, where if oneness is the real truth and all the purpose of our life is to actually find that oneness and honor different life forms, then how would we redesign our economy? Not make some small tinkering changes, but really relook at it completely. And it seems all the countries part of the G20 summit said yes to committing, you know, some resources, spaces to experiment it completely. And he's now in Brazil taking the G20 ahead. So something is shifting. I think there is a recognition that our systems need to completely change. And when we relook at them with a completely new principles, then maybe what Brian was saying, the educators and the healers, and, you know, they will be valued differently. So I'm hopeful and positive.
Thank you, David. Dinesh Uncle passed in the chat, so we'll go to Gulshan and then Jeanette.
Hello, everyone. Gulshan here. Thank you, Brinda, for the beautiful reading. And thank you so much, Michael, for joining and writing this passage. Last night, my daughter and son-in-law joined for dinner. And actually, we have a family textile business ground. And my son-in-law, my son, and myself both are into textile business. And we shared about this passage. And we all had a lot of thinking about this, your beautiful passage. So actually, exactly 12 months back in April 2023, in our business, we thought, let's include everyone, right from the packaging staff to the chief accountant to the head salesman, everyone include into the profit sharing. Like the more we profit, the more all the team members will get. So, and in the result of these 12 years, we got, I think, more than 100% growth. Like the profit is double, the sales are double, and we are less like there is a lot of comfort. We are less burdened. Everyone is now included. Another thing, my son joined 4 years back into our textile business. And the very first day he visited the textile factory, the mill, and he was very disappointed by the color chemicals. We were into polyester manufacturing. So, and being joining the service space community and being in all the circles, back of the mind, even I had thought this polyester thing is not good for environment, but I do not have the courage to shift to lose all the financial comfort. But just with the thought, it so happened, organically it happened, that gradually we shifted from polyester to cotton. And again, because there are very few people in the cotton in our city, 99% people are, or more than 99% into polyester. So we got the edge in the fashion industry. And again, our profit and business growth. Of course, cotton is not 100% environment friendly, but it is better than polyester. So all these things happen. And one more thing, we have a staff from last 50 years, from the time of my father, they joined, and their third generation is about to join us. Already two generations are our team members, and third generation is about to join us. So these are the few sharing I was thinking. And one quote that reminds me a lot, at the time of Gandhi, there was one to many. And then at the time of Vinoba, one to one in service space, we always say this. And now maybe it's time to many to many. So thank you so much for listening so patiently.
Thank you, Gosha.
We will go to Jennifer next and then Jeanette.
Hello, so nice to see you, Brinda. Love your reading, and what an honor to have the author read this. When I was in New York in a final round for an interview as an investment banker at Merrill Lynch, I was 22. I remember my final question was, what do you value more, money, power, or prestige? And the interviewer was very confident. And this was before my spiritual awakening in business school a few years later. But I remember a voice inside my head thought, neither. It's love that I value the most. But I knew that wasn't going to get me the right answer in investment banking. So I said, money, because then you can buy power and prestige. And fast forward later, when I kind of left Wall Street and have started doing jobs that make a difference in the world, which I love,
but definitely was making a money versus making a difference choice. I now feel you can combine them in a different way, but it's the world's changing. And when I read your passage, another thing I thought of was recently I've been learning a lot about relationships because I had one that, you know, because love is so important, but it's not always completely inherently obvious how to have smooth relationships, even with people you love, let alone what's going on in the world. Like, you know, it's so hard to have good communication with people you want to have. It's not surprising we have mishaps, but I remember seeing some videos talking about good relationships. People both try to enhance each other's lives. So someone's trying to love the other person they want to be loved, and the other person's trying to love you the way you want it to be loved. And in this video, a man said, but I want my needs met. You know, if I'm just giving everything to this other person, how do I get my needs met? And the coach was pointing out that if both people are doing this the same way, that's, we all meet each other's needs. You know, it's, and so it was interesting for me, this question about self-interest. It's such a basic human need. And yet I think most of us have the basic instinct. Really, we do want to give. It's kind of like if we can relax into, you know, as I do more spiritual meditation and things, it's easier for me to see that my interests and others are the same. But it's definitely, I think, Michael, you really hit the issue, having gone to business school and studied economics and being in business, you know, people equate self-interest and money as separate, and they don't have to be.
Thank you, Jennifer. We'll go to Jeanette next and then to Guri, because the alphabet is wired that way tonight. So over to you, Jeanette.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm really grateful to be here. My name is Jeanette, and I'd like to thank Brenda for the beautiful reading. It was such a long passage, and you did it so beautifully and eloquently, as Brian said. And thank you, Michael, for what you wrote and for being present to reflect upon it for us. I did enjoy the passage from a scientific standpoint, how it analyzed and broke things down. The part that really resonated with me is, my phone went up. What is in it for me underlies most economic thinking. Economists dating back to Adam Smith have argued that acting from self-interest will produce a vibrant economy for all. Perhaps we should be asking, what is in it for us to bring things into balance? To me, this paragraph is very profound, because it not only it applies to the economy and the world, it applies to human relationship. If we are at any place with anyone and ask the question, what is in it for us, how it will resonate, the love and the compassion that we can have in that situation. So thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you, Jeanette. We'll go to Guri next, and then to Carrie.
Hi, everyone. I loved the passage as well. I felt like it wasn't just about business to me. I felt like it applied to, you know, almost every aspect of our lives in some sense. The idea, the analogy of a longer ladder will not help us reach the moon. In some sense, so much of our times, our lives, I think, whether, you know, personal or social or global, a lot of the times we kind of our mind has this way of sort of kind of circling around the same thing, as opposed to being able to leap out of it and find a new solution, and find a way to work with something in a way, to approach it in kind of a fresh way. And I was reminded of that scene in The Matrix, the first movie in The Matrix, where I don't know how many people have seen it, but it was kind of a classic growing up, where Morpheus, Neo first meets Morpheus, you know, the kind of the all-knowing, and he said, do you want the blue pill or the red pill? And then, you know, once you take the red pill, like, there's no going back. It's all around you, but once you become aware of this rabbit hole, like, you know, you're going to go down it, and you cannot imagine life kind of otherwise. So that's what the passage reminded me of, that in some sense, when we can kind of leap out of ourselves and look at the same thing in a new way, whether it's, you know, whether it's something just for our own internal purposes, where we look at something all of a sudden with fresh eyes, right? Byron Katie has amazing questions around the work when we look at something. And is it true? Like, to really kind of have a genuine inquiry into anything that we're interested in, I think it leads us to a different place, as opposed to kind of being on that same wheel. So that's what arose for me. And I really enjoyed listening to everybody's thoughts. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Guri. Thank you, everybody. And Michael, I think we've crossed paths before, have we not? It's really good to see you. I will keep my comments short because I actually have something to share in the after hours. But what I loved in the passage was the mention of survival of the fittest, because I've heard that used in people use it in so many different contexts, and business is a really big one. Like, that's nature, right? It's our nature. It's what nature does. But I would kind of invite everybody to sit with nature for a period of time and see if that's actually true. You know, I've never found it true that nature is survival of the fittest. It's more about wanting to perpetuate itself and perpetuate life. Like, nature is for life. And in that light, I can say more in the after hours, but I have something special to sort of segue right off of that potential exploration. So we'll see you in a few minutes.
That's exciting. We're looking forward to the after hours. Let's see. Marina passed in the chat window, so we will close with Meritorious Pancakes, aka Mark.
I was going to use this week's passage as an excuse to talk about women's basketball, and specifically Caitlin Clark. But seeing as Michael is on the call and knowing his connection to the University of Michigan, it might not be cool to so openly celebrate an Iowa Hawkeye. And I see we're almost out of time, so I will just say it was so great to have you here, Michael, and Brenda, beautiful reading.
Thank you. All right. Wow. Well, we finished in an amazing time. Thank you to the collective intelligence for that. We typically close with a minute of silence just to soak in the space that has been shared and co-created together. So much gratitude to all the invisible forces that brought us together tonight to share such space in this way. Thank you all. Mark will ring the bell in about a minute.